All right. So how does this one work? What am I? You go first.
Yeah.
Right. And then, okay. All yeah. right. All right. Go. Just let's just see how okay. it goes. All right.
Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Patrick, I got a letter in the mail from a publisher who said you signed a letter authorizing our official biography.
Oh, yeah. Is that cool, Jim? I was a little short on cash this month, so I made a book deal for us.
Well, I guess, but I'm a little hesitant about the title.
What's wrong with When Two Doves Cry?
That's so good.
I like it.
Okay, I gotta say it without laughing.
I like it a lot.
What's wrong with When Two Doves Cry?
Take three.
Take three. What's wrong with When Two Doves Cry? We'll just use the whole thing.
Patrick, did you have fun at the Robert Dean Lurie
I had a great time.
Book signing?
Mm-hmm. It was excellent.
It was really fun.
Yeah, it was
it?
Really nice. Cool to see the mansion on O Street. Great to meet Robert in person. And it was nice. Some folks came down and we had a nice little group there. It was really good.
Yeah, so we want to thank Robert
yep.
for letting us be part of that. We want to thank the mansion on O Street for accommodating us. They were wonderful people.
Really, really good. The tickets were required, but they were free. So that's even better. My favorite kind of ticket.
They also had served drinks at there.
At a bar.
Yeah.
Great. It was our kind of place.
It works for me. So, yep. As I mentioned yesterday, this is part three today mm-hmm. of our live event that we did with Robert Dean Lurie, the author of Begin the Begin, R.E.M.'s early years. You and I are both R.E.M. fans from back in the day.
Yeah, we are.
You've mentioned during this that you became a fan based on the Police show?
That's right. Yeah, what he talks about in the book, I went to see R.E.M. open up for the Police at the Capitol Center, one of those, you know, like seven or eight shows they did opening up, and that was the first time I'd ever been exposed to the band, so got to thank the Police for that one.
So you were a fan from the very early.
Pretty early, yeah.
Days of R.E.M.
Yeah, not quite as early as, you know, before they were signed to IRS, but definitely on the first album, I started getting into them. So
yeah,
it was cool.
And I think, as I mentioned earlier, I got into them on the with the Fables of the Reconstruction album mm-hmm. was my introduction, and then went back and got the other two
yep.
at that point.
Yep.
All right. This is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And let's just press play here on part three
Sounds
of
good.
This event with Robert Dean Lurie.
My name's Kevin. It's been 26 years since my last REM show. Sorry. Also, I born in Ohio, but I consider myself a Georgia native because I lived there my whole life. So it's been a
Wonderful.
Lot of time.
Wow.
It's great to hear you talk about the Globe and all those places. That,
fantastic.
And actually, the one time that I ran into Michael Stipe in Athens was at the Globe. So
wow.
But anyway, my question for you is, what led you to write about music? What is it that, is it just the passion aspect of you have a passion for the music or
yeah.
and you wanted to write or
yeah,
what sort of led up to that?
Because really
I actually
that
read your the book you were talking about, The Church. So I actually read that about 10 years ago.
Well, first of all, God bless you for that. yeah, that's a great question. So I studied writing. I went to grad school, University of North Carolina, Wilmington. I just learned that we have a connection
right.
to that school.
Seahawks.
and I was on the nonfiction track. And so very practical kind of thing. You're casting about to figure out what you're going to write your thesis on. And the thesis is basically a book. So it's like, what could I possibly write upwards of 300 pages on in where it's going to sustain my interest? And they always say, write what you know. Well, I play guitar and I'm just a music fanatic like these guys. I mean, when I hear their podcast, it's like the contents of my brain. So had to be something about rock music. And that turned into the book about the church. The church is actually my favorite band that's not called the Beatles. And nothing had ever been written about them. So I knew that was going to be unique. And then it was a thing where, so I wrote that and it got published and then suddenly I'm a music writer. And it's a lot of fun. I did a little thing about David Bowie, which is kind of a mini book. And then this is the second kind of full-fledged music bio. And I don't think I'm only going to write about music, but it definitely falls into that write what you know category.
What is your relationship with any of the band members? I mean, you mentioned sort of running across mm-hmm. them. Did you ever sit down with them, meet them in any way? Or?
I should emphasize, this book is unauthorized. This is...
it's the best kind of book.
Those are the best biographies, aren't they? But I didn't want to write a Kitty Kelly type smear job. First of all, REM's manager is a lawyer, so you wouldn't want to do that. But so they have a policy, and I think it's pretty similar to how Bob Dylan's policy with biographies and also the late David Bowie. You know, there were a lot of books about those guys too, and neither of them ever participated with the writers. REM actually did participate with a writer named Tony Fletcher, and there's various iterations of his biography, and they did full participation with that one. And they have done here and there some of the other books, like Peter Buck might do an interview or Mike Mills might do an interview. So it's not like a total cut and dry thing. But as far as my personal relationship with them, it's just very – it's – I don't know. I don't really know these guys. I met Michael Stipe a couple times when I was at UGA, and I dearly hope he doesn't remember any of those meetings because I was just the sort of slack-jawed fan. I have – obviously, a lot of mutual friends with them, and I have communication with the REM office. But just seeing them all over the place, but I don't really know them.
You know, Robert, I was wondering at reading this book, something that, you know, I think you sort of hint at, and maybe it's true, and there are some concrete examples. Do you think the Athens scene would have been what it was without New York? Because that was a really important connection for those early bands, Pylon, B-52s, and also REM, right?
Yeah, it is. It's they really wanted to recreate this kind of funhouse mirror version, unintentional funhouse mirror version of the New York scene. So at first it was like everyone was hearing those records and reading New York Rocker and stuff like that, but they couldn't really afford to get up there. I mean, every now and then you might be able to do kind of a road trip up to New York City for a weekend or something. But so it's like a lot of this, they weren't actually getting there and seeing it. They were just kind of inspired by it and creating their own thing, but it had a Southern accent and had this kind of weird small town Southern thing. You had characters in the wings like Howard Finster influencing, you know, they just all fell in love with his sort of, I don't want to call his artwork naive because that sounds kind of insulting, but the sort of almost like childlike innocence and beauty and mysticism to his work. And the other guy that did the Whirly Gigs, and I can't remember his name now, but so all of these things kind of came together. But yeah, there's this desire to be like the New York scene and kind of gritty and unfortunately also some of the drugs of the New York scene trying to replicate that. And then they did eventually start making these pilgrimages up to New York. And the B-52s and the Pylon like got up there as quickly as they could and really tried to establish themselves in New York. And this was an interesting thing about REM as well, because REM decided not to do that. It's just like the thing with the Police, like, I don't know who was driving this in the band, but they just felt like we need to kind of really build up our thing away from the spotlight so that when we do finally play there, we're just going to just kill it. And that's absolutely what they did.
Yeah. Let's break Atlanta before we break New York.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Anyone else have any questions? Okay, great.
My name's Mike. I had a question. I recently read the biography on The Replacements,
yeah,
Trouble Boys, and it talks a bit about the relationship between the two bands.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, clearly they were friends, but they were also competing with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to hear you say about how REM was not really immediately ambitious, I guess. They were very conservative about how they wanted to proceed. Because from reading that book, my impression was more that basically, you know, REM had their act pretty much together.
Yeah.
And the Replacements were kind of, you know, self-inflicting their own wounds, destroying their own career at every step. Mm-hmm. And even I think they comment that, you know, some of the guys in REM kind of, you know, looked at them like, you got to get your act together here.
Right.
So one comment about or a question about the relationship between the two bands. I also had a question from that book. It was interesting in retrospect to realize that the Replacements were not really very popular when they first went to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if the same thing was true, that REM really had to work hard to kind of gain any traction in Europe in playing as a live band.
Well, there's you guys, it sounded like you were going to say something.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, compared to the Replacements, you know, we have our act together.
Yeah, and I think so. Also, to kind of clarify what we were talking about earlier with REM being perceived as conservative and playing covers and stuff like that, that was more to do with the perceptions within the Athens community. So actually, REM, everything you said is completely true. So REM, when Bill committed to being in a band again, which he had previously said he wouldn't do anymore, he and Mike were in a band in high school. And it started to kind of get somewhere, but not far enough. And he said, there's nothing in being in a band.
That's right. The farming life for me.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Actually, so his thing at UGA was he wanted to get a MBA and either go into the business side of music, which he had a little bit of experience in, or something to do with athletics and like the business side of that. I don't know. Right. So
anyway, I interrupted you.
So to get back to what you were talking about, when they did decide to make a go of it as a band, they were thinking in very specific career terms. But it was very much this idea of let's grow this thing. Let's kind of create a network of cities we can play in. But they had a plan for sure. And that absolutely distinguishes them from the Replacements. The other part of your question you'd asked about Europe, and this was interesting. This turned out to be a perceived deficiency with IRS. And I want to say that as carefully as possible because I don't know all the ins and outs of that, but I think they felt that they weren't getting as much promotion overseas as they would have liked, and that was one of the deciding factors in them moving to a major label like Warner Brothers that had more of a reach. So they did tour the UK and Europe, particularly in 1985 when they were touring Fables, and there was some amazing footage on YouTube of them playing in Germany, which I don't know if you guys have seen, with Michael Stipe with the bleached blonde hair, and you've seen it?
Yes.
Yeah. Some of the best live footage of REM ever. Yeah. And it's clear that the crowd seems to be enjoying it. I think there's a little bit of, they're also a little perplexed. And it's also clear they're playing in a pretty small venue.
Yeah.
So once they got with Warner Brothers, then they were able to really break it wide open. So,
speaking of the Warner Brothers, so you write about the early years here.
Yeah.
What Patrick and I have found in various podcasts we've talked about REM is almost like two different bands in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly you find that with the fans. There are a large group of fans who don't really know the IRS records at all, you know. And then there's the people like you all, I assume, who just cherish those records and mm-hmm. maybe discount the Warner stuff to mm-hmm. some regard. I'm just curious, kind of where do you sit as a fan, first of all, of yeah. REM? And mm-hmm. and do you find that same dynamic as well among people you've talked with or met?
Yeah. There is absolutely a divide. There's three phases of REM, really. There's this period, there's Warner Brothers up through New Adventures in Hi-Fi, and then Bill Berry left the band, and then there's kind of the later REM as a trio. And one of the things I learned as I was researching the book and reading all these other books about REM, I had no idea that those later albums were actually hugely successful overseas. And they're playing like massive, massive places. And so there must be a contingent of fans that's really into some of that later stuff. I think initially I was pretty snobbish, like it's just the IRS years and I like Automatic for the people, but other than that, you know. But actually learning more about them, I came to really appreciate like the entire run. I would say that as far as like albums and really succinct, near perfect statements of music and lyrics, you can't beat the IRS stuff. But I think they were writing amazing songs like all the way up to the end. It's just that the later albums seemed a bit patchier to me. So now I like all of it, but I don't think I could continue the story really, because when REM gets to Warner Brothers, they're really at that point kind of in rarefied air. You know, they're living a type of life that the door has kind of closed to me in terms of understanding or relating to that. Whereas all of this material, they're still in Athens, and although they're becoming big, it's kind of recognizable. And I don't know if I have the insight to be able to write about super mega big rock stars. So. Any other questions?
Here we go. Step up, sir.
You had touched upon this earlier, the discussion about their fondness for covers. And I'm just kind of curious about the evolution or de-evolution of their reliance on covers. It did strike me that it was probably driven in large part by Peter Buck, the record store clerk who just was a passionate music fan, and his desire to kind of proselytize and bring all this great music, out that he didn't expect people had probably heard. But at some point when that ambition kicked in, and I'm not sure when that was, I think they probably started to kind of de-emphasize that. And I'm just curious about the dynamic and how they felt about sort of the changing nature of the bands from this band that could kind of do whatever they want to, we've got to focus on our original material. This is our new identity.
That's a really cool question. There actually seems to be a pretty clear tipping point there. And I wrote about this I've been thinking about this since the book, like, am I imposing that idea on this? But there was a gig that they did in Ottawa at a place, I can't remember the name of it actually, but it was a fairly small venue, and they were already kind of smashed when they started the set, but someone was heckling Michael Stipe about an hour into the show, and they just got so furious that they they had just started their encore when this happened, so they just kind of decided spontaneously that they were going to do an hour of pretty much straight covers, just punishing stuff. Like, they did Sweet Home Alabama, they did Smoking in the Boys Room, and it's funny. And it sounds like a replacements gig. You can actually hear this gig. There's a website called the REM Timeline, where they have basically the set list of every REM show as best as they can surmise. And someone actually just recently posted the recording of it to that site. And it is like, the Sweet Home Alabama is the most god awful version of that song you will ever hear, but it's also strangely great. But I wrote about this, and my perception of that show is that's kind of the last time you see that version of REM. And I don't know if these things are related. I sort of get into a little bit of conjecture that they are related, that they had kind of an emergency band meeting pretty quickly after they did that gig. And once they finished that tour, like they never did stuff like that again. They would still do random covers here and there. Like they had a fondness for doing Aerosmith's Toys in the Attic. And I love their version of it, but it's also kind of awful, but great. But at that point, it's a shift towards this is what we are as original songwriters, and this is kind of the REM thing, and we're no longer that party band. And I think something was actually lost at that point. It's like it's a move that they had to make, but something was also lost in the spontaneity and the craziness of it.
Yeah, and I'll just say really quick, I know we're getting to the end of our time here, and you guys got to buy this book. One quick thing I'll say about buying the book, there are a lot of great stories in there. One thing I love, I won't tell the whole story, but how you could tell what Michael Stipe was wearing by going downtown in Athens was really funny. But, you know, the underlying thing, too, in this book, Robert, is that they were, unlike most rock stars, they were very, very savvy with their money. They, like, invested in real estate, yeah. And, you know, they owned, like, half the town, it seemed like, at one point. And, you know, they had real estate advisors. They were never, like, the Stones who never knew where their money was.
Right.
And, you know, couldn't get a check and had to leave the country because there were tax problems. I mean, they were extremely savvy about where their career was going. And I think it speaks to what you were saying about how they slowly, gradually built and took the right steps at the right time. So totally makes sense what you're saying about, you know, hey, we can't be doing that stuff anymore, right? Right? We have a career to sustain here.
And it's interesting, again, comparing them to the Replacements. It's interesting that gig is such an anomaly for REM, whereas that was kind of the status quo for the Replacements to do that kind of stuff, which is why so many people love the Replacements. But yeah, and I'll just say one quick thing about the sort of business acumen of REM from the beginning. This was the night and day difference from the first band I wrote about, The Church. Like, it was just astonishing that REM kind of had that down from the start. And also, like, they still managed to have some of that rock and roll decadence, more than you would probably associate with REM, but always, like, had... They never went into the red on anything, you know. They drove around in a van, probably longer than most bands would, because they were keeping it in the black. And then once they could afford it, then they had the bus, but not before.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So thank you again. I want to thank you guys for coming on board with this.
No, thank you, Robert.
I'm such a fan of what you do. And you really, like, the way that you work together, it's like a single organism. It's really, really a sight to behold.
Thank you very much. people have often said that about Jim and I, and we actually can't stand each other. So it's great that you
say
that.
I was going to say, I don't know how my wife's going to feel about that statement. Let's move on. Begin the Begin, REM's Early Years.
It's
Robert
great.
Dean Lurie. It's on Verse Chorus Press, and thank you for being on our show. Thank you for appearing here in front of these fine folks, and thank you for writing this book, because as REM fans, we need this.
Yeah.
All right. Again, thanks to Robert Dean, and thanks to O Mansion, and everyone. Go out and get this book if you can. Go to Amazon or what have you, and get Begin the Begin. R.E.M.'s early years. I think you'll really enjoy it. It's a really fun read.
And it is available on Kindle, I can report. Folks.
Very good.
So, yeah, you can download it on your reading machine and just do it right there.
I mean, I am really impressed with the people he talked to in compiling this book. That he went back and found the people who were there in the very early days of the band. Who understood what was really happening at that time.
And in many cases, weren't really on the record anywhere else. So that's kind of interesting, too, that he sort of, you know, officially documented their stance and their perspective. So that's cool.
Very good. All right.
Great work. Next will be the story of Suburbs Pod.
Yeah.
Evolution.
Oh, I don't want to know who they're going to interview for that.
No, I don't either. We better not.
Yeah.
That'll be an unauthorized biography.
Of course. Yeah.
All right. Kitty Kelly.
All right. Okay, well, let's get out of here.
Okay.
This concludes another broadcasting week.
Yes, it does.
Of Suburbs Pod.
Friday.
But please send us your thoughts and comments about REM. You can do that by calling. We'd like you to do that, and then we get your voice.
Love to hear your voice.
612-440-1984. If you still have a telephone, that kind of thing, do that. Or if you'd rather, you can email rock@suburbspod.com, or you can... fax us? No, you can Instagram.
Instagram,
Twitter or...
Facebook.
Tweet or Facebook us.
Facebooking.
All those at Suburbs Pod. Please do that.
If you've read the book, would love to hear your thoughts. Yeah. Is there something we didn't cover? Is there a question you would have asked, Robert? Love to hear those insights, too, if you read it and enjoyed it. And one thing I think we touched on, you know, one of the challenges was that there are so many books about REM, but to me, I've read a lot of those, and that one makes this even more interesting because it fills in some of the blanks that aren't really touched on in other areas. That's cool.
To me, one of the most fascinating things that I learned from the book, you and I were talking about this earlier today off air, was that Mike Mills wrote his own backing vocals for songs.
So interesting.
So Michael Stipe would basically be the main lyricist, but then any time they had those really cool backing vocal lines, Mike Mills would write those.
Yeah.
And he doesn't, just like any listener of REM, he didn't necessarily know what the songs were about. Right. So he's just kind of writing what he thinks would fit in there with the song.
So cool.
I've never really heard that with any band.
It's
have you?
Very neat. No. And I didn't know that either until I read this book. I thought that was really, really cool.
It makes me want to go back and listen to all those songs again and pick them apart a little bit more.
Especially on Fables where they're really buried in the murk. Yeah. Like, wow, that's really cool.
That was amazing. All right. Okay, let's get out of here. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you guys next week.
So as I mentioned at the top, I went to Indiana University, mid to late 80s. And at that time, they were recording there in Bloomington, Indiana, recording Life Search Pageant. Mm-hmm. So are there any, you know, did you uncover any great stories about their time in Bloomington?
No.